You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
And so, welcome to Latanya Sweeney, who is going to be talking to us today about privacy rethinks and the example of privacy-preserving marketplaces. Latanya is a professor of computer science, technology, and policy at Carnegie Mellon University, an affiliate of the CRCS Center at the Engineering School. So, welcome, Latanya.
Thank you. Wow, it's great to be here. One of the things I wanted to talk about is sort of joint work that I've done through CRCS and also with Sandy Pentland at MIT. In fact, the idea of privacy-preserving marketplaces actually started as conversations among CRCS. But it's great to be here at Berkman. I consider this the fountainhead and sort of the lighthouse of many policy directions and so forth. So that's really great. And I'm required to put this up, which is a disclaimer that says that whatever I say, it's nobody's opinion. So what I thought I'd do is, if it's okay, I'll just sit. Unless people want me to stand, I don't mind standing. But I thought I'd start by talking a little bit about the example of privacy-preserving markets, sort of to motivate it, give you a sense of how privacy rethinking is unfolding, and then just sort of dive into privacy rethink. So as many of you went around the table, there are several of your projects that actually already are involved in sort of these privacy rethinks. And so we'll talk about what the components are and so forth. But basically, as we go through our daily life, you know, copies of information about us appear in some database somewhere, and the data gets assembled, giving many details with respect to mobile phone locations, your IP information, IP log information, credit card transactions, and so forth. And so in many ways, this is the age of big data, and big data is what's really driving a lot of the privacy rethinks as it challenges past privacy protections. Just to give you an example, this is a chart I filled out on a survey we had done at the Data Privacy Lab looking over the last six years of all the places that a person's health data would go. Sort of this hypothetical but typical patient named Alice. And what's really shocking about it is you see some places that you would expect, such as the provider, managed care organization, and so forth, but then employer and lots of other places you wouldn't expect. And so the challenge of big data is not only the fact that so much detailed information is collected about people, but that the sharing of it is broad and hidden. There's a lot of money in big data. In fact, that's what helps drive the sharing. To give you a couple of examples, the World Economic Forum has dictated the sharing of data as an asset class among corporations. So a new asset is exactly the data that you have. For this group, it's not surprising when we think that Google's entire model is based on using someone else's data, and the same thing with revenues for Facebook. PricewaterhouseCoopers, just in medical data alone, estimated that this year it'll be a $2 billion market. So that's uses of data sharing of health information outside of the care of the patient. So with so much data sharing, you expect there to be a litany of harms. But one of the problems is that there's a lack of enforcement and a lack of transparency to actually tell us about the harms that are going on. Let me give you a couple of examples. So many years ago, it was reported that a Maryland banker had cross-referenced credit card debt and mortgages at his bank with information he found on a publicly available cancer registry and began to tweak the credit worthiness of those creditors. Now, we don't actually know whether it's true or not, but it's certainly possible, and that gives us a sense of examples. Linode at the University of Chicago did a survey of Fortune 500 companies, and a third of them admitted to making hiring, firing, and promotional decisions based on health information. And just even more recently, in terms of a lack of transparency, by 2006, there had been 20,000 allegations of privacy harms under the Health Information Privacy and Accountability Act, HIPAA, in the United States. But the government had only prosecuted 8 cases. So it gives you a sense that it's not necessarily the case that the harms aren't happening as much as that the sharing is hidden and the harms are hidden as well. Or you may feel the harms, but it'd be hard to identify where it came from. Now, given that, the response to these potential harms can't be to prohibit data sharing altogether. Big data also can help society in many ways. Some good examples are revolutions in computational social science, pharmacogenomics. All of these have the potential to transform our understanding of our lives, our organizations, and our societies in incredible ways. But they require not only the collection of this detailed data, but also sharing it broadly. Which leads to the question, how can society share data widely while protecting data subjects from harm? And that's really the key question. So the old way this was done, one big instrument, was de-identification. The idea of removing explicit identifiers from the data with the like name and address and believing that you could share that widely. So prior work that I had done back in 1996 looked at the idea of medical data, which had no name and address on it, and showed how basic demographics could be linked to population registers like voter lists to re-identify individuals. And we found that 87% of the people could be re-identified based on their zip code, date of birth, and gender. Now, that was in 1996, and that was before Google. It was before most of what we think of the web and data sharing existed today. It was certainly before iPhones. And now, in 2011, the question has come up again as to how do we do re-identifications. And so that most recently came up as a part of the Sorrell case in the Supreme Court, for example. And so what we find is that there's so much data now that's not even just demographics that we can use. We can use many other components in the data to help begin to re-identify. So it brings forward a new era of re-identifications, challenging that approach, de-identification as a good way forward. Another old way has been informed consent. The idea of informed consent is that a researcher could tell a subject all of the risks that would be involved before they would voluntarily give some of their bodily parts or materials for research. Even that's being challenged as we look at things like how DNA, the more we learn, the more we can infer that back into the same data that we just talked about. So what you see here is sort of inferences that have been learned over time from DNA, how I could infer various information, and then began to do the same kind of re-identifications. So when we think about these challenges to old practices, it gives us opportunities for new thinking. And so what I'm going to give you is a couple of examples of new ways of thinking at a bigger level. So the first one is by George Church at the Harvard Medical School. George Church says, look, you know, I can't possibly tell someone, I want their genomic information, but I can't possibly tell those data subjects the actual risk that they may undergo because I don't know what we might learn about genomic information later on. I don't know who might use it. And so I can't inform you. So I'm going to turn it all around. Instead of me giving you informed consent and you signing it, you're going to do the opposite. I'm going to give you a document to sign, and I'm not going to take any responsibility. I'm not going to guarantee you any privacy. In fact, I'm going to put your data on the web. And I want you to sign that you'll absolve me of any liability if any harm comes to you. It sounds kind of wacky. So, but right now they have 1,000 people signed up with about 300 people who already have their genomic and medical data freely available on the web. This is the open consent model. There's also been the trade secret model. The trade secret model, again, is with genomic data. You give the researcher genomic data, and they will treat it as if it's a trade secret. The idea being that they may give you some compensation or some consideration for it, but as long as no one else knows the information that they gain from your genomic data, then, in fact, you're covered sort of in theory as a trade secret. The problem with that is likely to be challenged over time in 5 years, almost many major clinical procedures will require DNA information about you. So as part of your differential diagnosis by the doctor, he'll run certain genetic tests. Those tests become part of the health record, the very health data that we saw was widely distributed earlier. So this idea of the trade secret may come back and bite them. But one of the things that's true about both the open consent model and the trade secret model is they basically flip it around and say that you only have yourself to blame. You consented to this or you received something in exchange for this. So given those two, they are two broad new ways of thinking about it, but they don't actually prevent people from being harmed. And so what we really want is a way forward that gives us a way to share personal data with some guarantees from harms. And that's sort of the motivation behind this concept of privacy-preserving marketplaces. How can we insulate or compensate people for harms? So the idea, I don't know if I'm going too fast, but I'm getting lots of head nodding, which encourages me to speak faster. So if you don't want me to speak faster, either raise your hand or start shaking your head no. Sure. So this is by Mitchell and his colleagues, and what they propose, they're researchers who want to work on your genomic information. You give them genomic information, they'll give you a contract. In the contract, it says that that what you've given them, they will harbor under whatever trade secrets provisions there are, which do vary from state to state. And in exchange for that, they will go ahead and use your data for research, and they'll give you some kind of compensation for that. And then the problem with it as a trade secret is if the knowledge that's the subject of the trade secret becomes known, then they're no longer bound necessarily by those protections that were adhered to in, as a trade secret. And so that's a problem. I'm leaving my DNA all over the place. The medical infrastructure in this differential diagnosis is going to start gathering more and more and putting it in my record. So the idea that I could use it as a trade secret might be problematical. Does that help?
Examples of trade secrets?
So a good example of a trade secret, probably the most popular one, would be Coca-Cola. So the actual formula for Coca-Cola is considered a trade secret. But there are bottling companies around the world for that bottle Coca-Cola. And so there are two models that Coca-Cola tends to use, is at least my understanding. And the two models they use is one is they ship you the syrup, and then you make the Coca-Cola from that. And the other one, they actually ship you ingredients, and you mix the ingredients to produce the syrup that produces the soda. And all of those, in both of those cases, the bottling company has a trade secret arrangement that they are using the knowledge or have the secret knowledge of the magic recipe, but that they don't share it or will use it. Okay. So what we want to do is figure out how to design market components. So in other words, we want to look at data sharing arrangements as a market, all data sharing arrangements as a market, and we want to design those components in a way that the market can make some guarantees about either insulating a person from harm or compensating them for harm. And we want it to work not just with genomic data, but with multifaceted data. And this kind of approach can offer you different remedies and different kinds of data sharing. Let me give you some examples. Well, first of all, let me just tell you what I don't mean. What I don't mean is a free market. So I don't mean that individuals would just take all of their personal data that's somehow now under their control and then just offer it to the highest bidder. Because the problem with a free market is it doesn't actually guarantee that you won't be harmed. So people, just because it's a higher price doesn't mean that there's not a harm that can come to you. So the question is, how could we actually protect you? A good example of it in the context of open consent and trade secret is an example where, let's say, I give you genomic data, and in the open consent model, they give me back a yearly report of what's known about me. So that sounds pretty nice. There's sort of a market happening where I gave you genomic data. Every year, you give me updates about what science now knows specific to my genome. The problem is that you could actually lose your life insurance. And there's no protection against you, for you, against that problem. And it was sort of this unforeseen consequence of participating. How do you lose your life insurance? Well, at some point in time, let's say the report comes back that says you're highly likely to develop a particular disease. And let's also say that you subsequently have to apply for life insurance. Now, if you say that you are likely to have this disease, you may suffer higher premiums or they may deny you life insurance altogether. If you don't say that you were predisposed to this disease, then that you can pay your premiums, and upon your death, they may deny the payment, claiming that you knew about it and didn't disclose. And so the participation in that example would be a sort of a market failure. But there are some interesting examples. So you could imagine a very simple differential privacy. I know that's been a constant topic among the CRCS people who take great pride in that. But you can imagine a very simple, I have a, a market of individuals who all have their data. They're in this marketplace, and I'm public health, and I just want to ask a simple statistic about how many people might have H1N1 virus, or how many people might be having the flu today or having flu-like symptoms. And I just want an answer, and differential privacy can make some strong guarantees that the answer, the estimate that I would get back is somewhat accurate, but that no one's information would be revealed in the process. So that would be an example of a differential privacy model. Another model is a data insurance model. It might be the case that we offer, in the example I gave before, you can imagine we might say, suppose we underwrote everyone who participated in the genomic marketplace with a data sharing insurance model, so that if you did lose your life insurance, we would actually pay this. And at first it sounds a little hokey, this notion of a data insurance model, but in fact it's not hard to get the monies because there's so much money in the data to compensate for the data insurance model. The hard part historically for having data sharing insurance is being able to prove that you were actually harmed through the data sharing. So it's the lack of transparency. And one of the things I am very proud to announce is that HHS announced on Friday they proposed a change to the HIPAA privacy rule to include individual audit trails. So an individual can say, I want an audit of all the places my data have gone. This is something I strongly requested of HHS last year, and I'm delighted to see that they're going to do this because, in fact, it will enable data sharing insurance. So those are examples of marketplaces. And there are other possibilities of what a privacy-preserving marketplace might be, too. It could be a services market. That is, if we all had all of our data in this marketplace, somebody may actually want to sell us a service by linking across the multiple facets of data we may hold. That is, in a data sharing, in a marketplace, I might basically collect all of the data that's in my name. So in other words, I can get my health data, I might be able to get my utility data, I might be able to get my transactions from my credit card, all of it, sort of this multifaceted data under my control to participate in a marketplace, or to participate in a marketplace. And a services market would then allow me to use different components of data. That is, my credit card data might be crossed with some other piece of data in order to give me a service back. And we've also talked about the various things that could be done in health information. So I sort of gave a really brief idea. We can go into details, but I kind of want to paint the surface enough that we can open up the floor a lot more for discussion. Let me just say a little bit more about marketplaces, what kind of money is involved. A report I had done back in 2002 reversed what was the expenses currently being charged for medical data and said how much is that per person, and it came out with these amounts, that basically researchers were paying $10 a person for explicitly identified data, $1 if it were de-identified but could be re-identified, 10 cents it seemed to be anonymous, and a penny if it was likely to be anonymous. And so that gives you a sense of the kind of money that, the market's already providing. The other thing that's hidden in this whole conversation about privacy-preserving marketplaces is this idea of personal data vaults, the idea that I could actually assemble all of this data about myself. And you say, how likely is that to be? How real is that? But we have a lot of examples already. They're not privacy-preserving marketplaces, but they certainly lead us in that direction. So one of them is personal health records. So that would be Google Health. That would be Microsoft Health Vault. They're not privacy-preserving marketplaces, but they already want to assemble, for example, information about our health data and put it in one place under our control. You could easily imagine them evolving into having privacy-preserving marketplaces. And in fact, Microsoft recently announced that they've made, well, I don't know if they've announced it, but they've made an arrangement with the FTC to actually use a differential privacy model to try to predict adverse effects of drug reactions based on data that's in Microsoft Health Vault. So we've started to see the emergence of this notion of privacy-preserving marketplaces, even though it's not fully adopted. There are also these things called health information data banks, and these are, again, the data gets assembled under your name. And the idea of these data banks is that whereas in personal health records, the data is under someone, you assemble it, but it's under someone else's control, presumably so that you could have your assembly of the data, i.e. the Microsoft Health Vault or Google Health Vault. But in the Health Information Data Bank, it's under your control, and the bank that holds it doesn't even have a right to see it except through court order or something like that. And there are gift databases. That's databases that are assembled usually by the government or a large company who turns over the data that belongs to you, and you may not even know you're in it, and they just sort of give it out to as a societal good. But you can imagine they too could begin to think about how could they protect individual subjects from harms and think about it as a privacy-preserving marketplace. So this kind of way of thinking about privacy-preserving marketplaces has some real-world tentacles, and that we can see how these tentacles are already developing. What we don't want is the tentacles to just go haywire, go wild, become a free market or become a data for service market, because individuals could be harmed. And so the way of thinking about these privacy preserving marketplaces is to force the designer of the marketplace to think about how do you insulate or protect or compensate for harm. Doesn't require any regulatory change. High tech in the space of healthcare already gives an individual now since 2009 the right to gather their own personal medical data. And as I said, the proposed HIPAA change would then give you the right to get an audit on data that had been shared about you. The World Economic Forum, through a lot of effort from both Berkman and the Media Lab at MIT, has also supported the idea through telecommunication companies who are looking to give you back control of your telecommunication, your phone data. So if we just compared these, that basically none of those three require any new laws. They all flip it around and turn the individuals somehow usually have some control over the data. We don't know what kind of research bias they introduce. It's not the same as consent bias, but it might be some bias. We just don't know what it might be. They also, at least in the last two, also tend to introduce this concept of contract rather than consent, sort of a stronger instrument, and that you get something in exchange for it. So it's not surprising there's some living labs. There's one being developed across Berkman and MIT, and there's one that we want to develop in healthcare and so forth. And on Sunday, the Washington Post also announced a company that is called Personal, I think they're called Personal.com, and they also provide, they now want you to collect your data, they'll sell the data and give you some compensation. They don't make any privacy guarantees. They just say, look, if we share your data, you'll actually receive some financial benefit from it. Whether it's adequate or not is a different question. So that's the idea of privacy-preserving marketplaces, and also in the process of talking about that, opened up the door to what was open consent and trade secret models as sort of new ways of thinking about privacy at an architectural level. But if we think about what is rethinking privacy, what are the components? Suppose you decide, no, I don't like any of those, and I like to design my own model. How do I think about that? So I'd like to give you some mechanics. This is sort of for those of you who are at the HyperPublic conference, this is sort of a continuation of that talk. And so the goal in all of these is to get rid of this tension between, or this false belief that's highlighted in red there, that in order for me to have the utility of this data, I have to give up privacy, or in order to have privacy, I have to give up utility, and find that sweet spot, sort of symbolized there in the blue, where society enjoys both utility and privacy. So that's really the goal. And today, we could have a whole talk about what are the rethinks that are currently happening within legacy environments. Sort of, in the United States, we don't have a comprehensive privacy law. So these rethinks have to happen in specific regulations that deal with a particular sector or a particular area. So throughout this talk, I've talked a lot about the changes that are underway in healthcare. There are big rethinks even happening within the space of de-identification, within informed consent, and within consent and notice on the internet, for example. What we have talked about, though, is ignoring legacy environments and rethinks that happen at sort of these architectural levels, too. So here are the design components. It comes down to these, and I'll just sort of go through each one of them very quickly to give us some fodder for conversation. So one piece of the design is, what do you do, a component is the data subjects. And in particular, what you're interested in is, what is their decision-making options? we can characterize these data subjects as how empowered are they, recognizing that they're vulnerable and that they're irrational. And what I mean by irrational, Tyler's not here, but is very much in that spirit of the economics of privacy, where it's hard for us, we discount decisions, privacy decisions and trade-offs, because we discount the long-term harms. And that's what I mean by irrational. So to what extent do you protect them? Technology developers, the way in the space of privacy we tend to look at technology developers is that by the designs that a technology developer builds, he's actually already made some policy decisions. And so one of the things we don't often think about, and as computer science professors we don't often teach, is that technology developers actually make policy in the United States with respect to privacy. And they can do that quickly because they can do rapid prototyping, and they offer some innovative technology in the process, but a simple design decision can make policymakers scramble. A classic simple example is the Sony video camcorder. When the Sony video camcorder came out, it still is the case, it has no mute button. But in the United States, we have different laws for video capture than we do for sound, because we have the electronic wiretapping and so forth. But by that design of that instrument, these two things became combined. And now it's causing some really wacky stuff. We see some cases where individuals who are videotaping in public are actually being charged with wiretapping laws because they captured sound, for example, and eavesdropping and so forth. So that's an example. Policymakers as part of the component. Well, policymakers, they tend not to do anything until they do something really fast, and they do it really sweepingly. So they react. In the United States, they're much more reactive. So basically something happens, hits the front page of the New York Times, Congress reacts. They can be incredibly disruptive. Things can be moving along quite nicely with a piece of technology, but tomorrow that technology may not have a market. It could be totally undermined. And policymakers, the pace is incredibly irregular. Nothing happens for a long period of time, and then all of a sudden they can get highly motivated and act very swiftly. And so you want to be able to insulate technology development from that process as well. So the more you can actually build in privacy protections in technology, for example, the less likely it is you're going to have this disruption from policymakers. So the last three are not actors as much as they are things that happen that make us do things a certain way when we think about architecting privacy. One of the things is the belief system of the participants. One of the things that happens often is false beliefs. That is, if you remember the red diagram I showed you earlier, if you can get people to believe that they have to give up privacy for utility, or they have to give up utility for privacy, even if there does exist, even if we can show that there exist many viable options in that blue space we talked about, if those who control the discourse keep you on the red, the blue will just never happen. And so this becomes an interesting strategy that one has to think about when you're rethinking privacy, is what will be the belief system of those who will oppose it as well as those who will participate in it. Another thing we often see in privacy discussions and this component to the privacy rethinks is who's going to benefit. There's money, there's fear, there's the use of ignorance, and there's the use of a lack of transparency. And those can be used against people, and they can be used for people. And you have to figure out how you're going to engineer those as well. And lastly are legacy environments. Now, in the United States, legacy environments are actually a little bit easier than they are in Europe or in Canada. Since we don't have a comprehensive privacy law, it's pretty easy to build something that doesn't seem quite covered by any privacy law. In the United States, it's good until it's not good, right? It's good until Congress says that's no good, or somebody passes a law against it. If you're trying to build it within the space of a legacy environment, then that's often pretty sluggish and you get bogged down quickly. Because in general, legacy environments are pretty rigid, and they usually have these sledgehammer kind of structures to them. And they just don't move, they don't give, and they're not very malleable. So one of the things that was interesting about the examples I gave, open consent, trade secret, and privacy-preserving marketplaces, they were, all of them allowed individuals to make decisions. Unlike sort of the way we think of these sort of rigid legacy environments that says all people will do this, all data will happen this way. Whether you like it or not, your data is going or not going. And so to the extent that you can build around legacy environments, your rethinks are probably more like better off than believing you're going to actually have to change a legacy environment. Okay, so those are the components of rethinks. I think what I'll do, instead of going into my past work or anything like that, I flew through those slides awfully fast, mainly because the people on the outside are half asleep and the people at the table are all nodding yes. So why don't I stop and see where people really are? Are they in the yes space, the no space, or the I don't know what's going on here space?
Early in your slides, you had the title Big Data. And I think the public probably, I'm guessing that the public doesn't know exactly other than Google. I mean, everyone is kind of guessing what Google might be doing with our data. But in the area of healthcare, which you mentioned HHS and that policy thing, I've come across IT companies here in Boston that are taking pharmacy data, like if somebody goes to the CVS and gets medicine or whatever, there's terabytes of data that they're buying and massaging that data and maybe anonymizing it or something, but it seems like there's a lot of money there. Is the public going to know about that? I mean, how is HHS going to inform people? Or is this kind of, it's probably an open-ended question, but it's something that I've come across in the last 7 or 8 years here in the IT field in Boston.
Well, I think that's a great question. So first of all, the use of pharmacy data. So again, we get into this patchwork place. HIPAA, while it covers health data by those who are directly involved in my care, doesn't cover all health data. So for example, most states get a copy of every hospital visit and every physician visit. Those are not, what happens to that data is not covered by HIPAA. And so that's a way that data leaks out of the system and can be used for re-identifications and other things. The pharmacy data that gets sold and used for other purposes is another example. In fact, health data is kind of on steroids because the stimulus bill has a component in it that's allocating something on the order of $40 billion to revolutionize healthcare, to try to put a shiny new computer on the desk of each health provider. And what that's done is they've set up regional exchanges. These are regional places that will collect all this data. And it's fueling a market of uses of that data. So the pharmacy data was certainly the subject of the Sorrell case for the Supreme Court that was decided last week. That in that particular case, I go to the pharmacy sells a version of my data to a data mining company, in this case known as IMS Health, and the data mining company then assembles profiles about me, takes off my, and uses those profiles about me to make profiles about physicians and sells those profiles to the pharmaceutical company.
Another point on McKesson, probably.
Yeah.
Are they even the same as this IMS Health? Or similar?
Well, my understanding of McKesson is that they're offering strategic data about the marketplace, which is not exactly the same as the Sorrell case. In the Sorrell case, the use of the data was specifically to go to the physician and say, Dr. David, I know you had 100 prescriptions of glucophage. How come you only gave 50 of them to my company and 50 of them were generic? And I began to now try to make him change his mind about the other 50. Yes, sir.
You said that no new laws are necessary. There is apparently, I understand the difference between having the data in a server in your house, which is covered by the fact that it's your house, and having your data in the cloud, where it's not necessarily considered private, even though you're in control of that virtual server. Is that related or relevant to what you're talking about?
Well, it depends. I mean, so the idea of a privacy-preserving marketplace within that sort of paradigm of thinking says it depends on what those who are hosting your data in the cloud, you know, what provisions have they made for you? So, for example, what if they actually store encrypted data? What if your data is encrypted and only you hold the key or something along those lines? Then that might be, they might limit their utility of the data, but on the other hand, they could make some guarantees to you. And so that's the part that's open for design. All we try to do in the marketplace is not answer the question for every design, but give you sort of guidelines to if you design a market and a data sharing arrangement in such a way that individuals are insulated or compensated for harm, then in fact you have one, or you don't. So if I just stick data in the cloud, there are vulnerabilities, and so therefore that wouldn't adhere on its own to a privacy preserving arrangement.
To sort of understand concretely sort of what this would look like. Let's say, you know, I go into a relationship with a personal care physician, a primary care doctor. Do I then, you know, get handed a contract with a bunch of boxes to check off or not check off about what's going to be done with my data? And how do we avoid having that adhesion contract where basically I either sign it this way or I don't see that doctor?
Well, so right now you already have that adhesion contract, right? Because it's called HIPAA. So, and even if the doctor asked you to consent or not, it doesn't matter because HIPAA has already prescribed what the doctor can and cannot do with your data. So all of the data sharing that we saw in that earlier slide, and I'll go back to it, you don't have any control over that. That's just outside of your control because it's sort of dictated by HIPAA. But what we're talking about is that the High Tech Act says that you now can get a copy of the data that's under your control. So the Markle Foundation has started what they call the Blue Button Campaign. It's a technology feature that they're trying to, through best practice, get all of the providers to adhere to. And the idea of the Blue Button is that there's a website that goes, you can click the Blue Button, authenticate yourself, and you get a dump of your medical information that's available through that facility, whether that's your insurance company or your physician's office or whatever that might be. And so then the idea of these personal health vaults would be a place that you could assemble that data. Because remember, in this world where all the data goes over there, it's only fragments of your data. It's only the data that specialist had or that provider had. But you could actually assemble all of the pieces. In some ways, your data would be more valuable.
What would be the mechanism by which I would say, yes, you know, CVS can have a prescription, so they need to fill it, but no, you know, Pfizer can't have a copy of it as well.
Well, so once you get the data under your personal control, then others have to offer you a marketplace environment, and whatever they design would determine what features you would have to provide the data. So for example, in personal.com, in that company, they do the selling and you just get the money, so you don't get to say yes or no. Other academic designs come up with these elaborate, like privateaccess.com has a model where you specify at every transaction who gets what, or you specify in gross categories who gets what. So, but for the most part, I think it's the best designs are yet to come as to what the best way of offering to you.
Be informed what the consequences are if I check off no to certain places. You know, what am I giving up? What am I giving up as a benefit if I say no? This data can't go to this particular party.
But it depends. I mean, suppose we have a marketplace in which we guarantee everyone's going to participate, in which we guarantee everyone benefits from. So it might be that we collect royalties over the group of it, and you only have to participate in a certain number of transactions, but you can choose which ones those are. But yet everyone gets compensated through the total kitty. I mean, that could be a market design, but I'm not advocating any particular design. Yes, sir.
It seems at first glance like the hard part is not getting your own data back, but rather not having all of the people who have it now being able to still sell it and use it the way that they want. Can you say a few words about, you know, if we had a marketplace like this, what would keep somebody who has a whole bunch of your data already from continuing to sell it to their benefit outside right. The marketplace?
Well, first of all, 3 years ago, the first part of your claim wasn't true. The first part of your claim that I could get a copy of all my data was not really there. Or that I could even, and even now, until the HIPAA proposed rule actually goes through, you don't even know all of the places they gave your data to, right? So the HIPAA proposed rule would allow you to generate one of these specific to your data, for example. And so we see over the last 3 years this movement of that infrastructure. But one of the things these things don't do is stop somebody else's from the money they make. So there are two things happening there. One, in terms of trajectories, one element of momentum has to do with that your copy is more comprehensive than any of the others. Because, my insurance company has those things that came up with claims. But if you're diabetic, they don't have your glucometer readings, your daily glucometer readings. They don't have many other pieces of data, or what was your eating like? So if you're diabetic, I can use your credit card data to figure out how often do you go to restaurants that don't necessarily have the healthiest menus. And so I might offer you a service about helping you make better food choices. There are lots of things that could be done, but I couldn't possibly do that if I only had your insurance claim data. So this idea that you could put multifaceted data specific to you in one place will make that data the richest. So that's one big boom for why this approach is to likely have far more value than the other kinds of data. And then the second reason is simply that if it works, if there is enough traction in these privacy-preserving marketplaces, if they evolve over the next 3 to 5 years, and they answer this privacy question well, that is that they really are privacy-preserving, then they'll actually put a lot more pressure on these other data sources who leak privacy, who have privacy harms and problems that aren't transparent, that aren't accounted for, that don't compensate you, don't insulate you. And so Congress is more likely, or HHS is more likely to react. So those are the sort of two. That's the crystal ball I see.
About the preserving part in these marketplaces, to me they seem more like privacy marketplaces where you sell your privacy and then you're rid of it. In particular, I wonder what... to me, it seems like a fact that the more you spread your personal information, the more likely it is that it will, in the end, be used against you.
Right.
And I wonder how it should be possible to, first of all, keep companies which buy your information from either selling it further without your knowledge, because it's hard to know, and the second, or how to make them take provisions against any kinds of leaks, which could compromise it, or which could leak your data to the general public.
Right.
So, which I don't really see how that would be possible, especially in the absence of in the absence of legislation.
So,
you could write a contract for participation in the marketplace. So you could certainly have legislation in the European style that greatly restricts what people can do with it, or potentially, if you get the marketplace right, if it's contractually obligated not to do those things, and then there's still the issue of figuring out how to prove they violated that contract, and then they're sort of dissuaded by damages rather than regulatory fines. But either way, you have the same problem of figuring out that they either violated the regulation or violated the contract.
The thing is, the European legislation has been particularly bad at actually making companies take care. I'm not sure that contracts, especially taking into account that many people are ignorant of how data can be used against them, how contracts could really ensure that the data is protected appropriately.
So, let me say a couple of things. I mean, you said a mouthful, and so let me begin to sort of peel some layers. One layer is to come up for air and come to an interesting realization that the United States, in comparison to Europe, is the Wild Wild West with respect to privacy and data, and Europe is a cultured society. So to the extent that you have problems in the cultured society, if you expect the United States to go from the Wild Wild West to being beyond cultured, that's probably not going to happen in one step. I'm just saying, I'm just trying to calibrate. And so what does it mean that we're the Wild Wild West, other than the fact that we don't have a comprehensive law? It means that I had no say about this. That means that HIPAA, which is our privacy rule for healthcare, the government has already dictated that data sharing will happen. without my knowledge or consent, and that the harms that may or may not come to me, only the government can actually take an action. There's no private right of action in HIPAA. And so when you see, you know, 20,000, 30,000 allegations, I think it is by now, and 8 convictions, that number, those two numbers really speak volumes about an inability for you to seek remedies for harms, right? What he was saying about moving to a contract, well, first of all, because you're a party to the contract, you, first of all, you actually know where, who you gave a copy of the data to. The contract is most likely to have limited use and so forth. And there are really some interesting ways, to some extent, we can show whether or not, identify some kinds of bad players. Not all bad players, but some kinds of bad players. And the other thing you can do is limit those who you provide the data to those who have the most to lose if they were determined to be bad players. So you can imagine marketplaces that only play to clinical trial researchers or big companies that would have a lot to lose if they were ever caught not adhering to the contract.
Especially that some people might feel pressured to sell their personal data because, yeah, for economic reasons.
Right.
And I think these people usually tend to be already most vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
And so I see possible very negative impacts for these people.
Right. And I think, you know, in general, in a free market, I think that's a really great point. It's the ethical consideration is huge. But in a privacy-preserving market, in some of the models that we've played with or certainly had in discussions and in sort of our weekly meetings, there was these concepts of, well, you know, you sort of have a privacy budget, and once you spend that budget, or it might be that every time you participate, you become more risky. Every time I share my data, I become more risky. So in some sense, I've then become more expensive, and I began to price myself out of the market. So there are lots of different ways that a good, well-designed market will make sure that that kind of incentive doesn't happen. A market that says the more you share, the riskier, the higher your risk for harm will tend to make the price of your data go up the more you participate. And then sooner, if somebody says, I need 100 people who have disease X, but you've priced yourself out because you've already participated in so many studies, you're not going to be able to participate. The market won't let you participate in that study.
I was a little surprised to hear about some of this stuff because I just didn't know about it. And I was wondering if you knew what the rationale behind HIPAA was that allowed them to share our data without our knowledge, and sort of how that might relate to things outside of our medical data. So other things that we do online, is there a similar parallel there or not?
Well, so almost overwhelmingly, in the United States, a privacy rule is almost in every case a data sharing rule. So it means that data will be shared, and the question is, what rights or remedies do we give you? So a good example is credit card reporting. I can't stop anybody from adding to my credit card report. But we use these things called fair information practices that says, yeah, but you can ask for a copy of your report. You can say that you challenge a charge that's on your credit card saying that it's not you. But notice that I don't have any control over who can see it or who can report to it, right? And so that's a very good example of how these privacy rules in the United States have tended to work. They all allow data sharing, and they just put rights and responsibilities on data recipients and data holders. But the individual then usually may have a right of review or right of knowledge. And so in HIPAA, that's exactly how it works. It says, you know, in the care of the patient, you're covered. And what it means to be covered is these are the only ways and people that ways you can give the data out. And it's irregardless of the individual's consent.
If people can share your data without your knowledge, then how can you sell your data? Like, when companies just get your data for free somehow?
Well,
how would there even be a market?
So,
or a is that more comprehensive package that you're...
Well, one is, one, yes, more, one, I argue that it will be more comprehensive, but the other part of that is, senior moment. I forgot what I was going to say. Say it again. Ask your question again.
I was asking if companies can just get your data for free, if they can share your data without your knowledge, then how can you sell your data? Or I just don't know.
So a lot of in PricewaterhouseCoopers, in estimating that $2 billion for the secondary sharing of health data, almost all of the companies are very, very nervous because they know you don't know. And they worry what will happen if they end up on the front page of the New York Times and Congress has to react. So they're very concerned about the disruption. And so, and that's also what's happening in the World Economic Forum. The telecommunication companies would like to share data, but they're very upset about what would happen, how would you respond. And so this idea that there could be this disruption that comes out because policymakers would be forced to take action is why a lot of companies feel far more comfortable with you being involved in the data sharing arrangement. And also, in fairness to the government, the idea that individuals could be directly involved is also is enabled by having a network society that we have now. So it's also something that's available now that wasn't available in the 70s.
Say a few words about the flip side of the equation. Let's say we had this perfect privacy-preserving marketplace and a researcher wants to get a broad spectrum of data in order to do a study. Isn't there a self-selection bias built in if you're only getting the data from people who are willing to sell it and at particular price points?
Yeah,
wouldn't,
I think there are...
Wouldn't the researcher rather have like a comprehensive data set where the person had no control over whether they gave it up or not, purely for reasons of statistical validity?
Well, yeah. There may very well be bias that correlates to those individuals. We just don't know what that bias is. And we don't know whether that bias runs orthogonal to research. So in the case of research, in the case of consent, there are tons and tons of studies that show research based only on those who consent can be biased. But in a consent model, the individual receives nothing. And so even though people might be motivated from a financial gain or for some other consideration like that, that may run orthogonal to the kinds of decisions of participation and therefore orthogonal to the kinds of consideration of bias than we saw in those earlier studies. That doesn't mean there is no bias. It means that we just don't know what that bias is and how we can articulate it as different bias, and that they're not, that two people aren't necessarily, that the decisions aren't exactly the same, they're not completely aligned either. But we don't know exactly the nature of that bias versus the research objective.
But if you were running a multi-million-dollar health study, wouldn't you have an incentive to not use data that might have this unknown bias in it?
Depends on the nature of the study. So if I wanted something that was, if I was studying something that, you know, had low probability of being a harm to you, something that you would normally, if I were to ask 1,000 people and 1,000 people would likely consent, then clearly in that case, whether they get compensated for it or not, they're still going to consent, right? They're still going to participate. If people who wouldn't consent won't consent because there was effort and they had to show up someplace, and why should I go out of my way to show up at this place to participate? But then on the other hand, in this other world, they get compensated for that. And, you know, now all of a sudden they're motivated because, yeah, I will go show up. But who's going to be more motivated to actually show up was certainly... creates a selection bias that's different than the bias of the research topic, which is what the prior issues about consent were based on. Doesn't mean that there aren't some concerns, yes?
I mean, just sort of to respond to that, I mean, pretty much any study that already exists has bias in the form of selection of participants. I mean, you know, you just have to read every psychology study that was done on undergrads at some university, because that's who they could get to come into the lab. And, you know, like, yes, this will introduce a different bias, and it might take time to understand how that affects results. But I don't think, you know, but certainly, like, every study has bias like that. There's no way to eliminate it. So, rather, I mean, unless you're going to, like, knock at people's doors at night and force them to participate in clinical trials. And that probably isn't a good model.
That assumes they're like, doors.
Yeah. That's fair.
And you don't get the really strong ones who knock out.
Please go ahead.
So one of the things we were talking about is that
people may not be compensated equally for this. So you could have a model where the marketplace, you ask it for a good sample and give it a budget, and it decides how much to pay each person. So it won't just pick, you know, all the cheapest people. It'll pick a few expensive people and a few cheap people, or it'll decide ahead of time, you know, which people it picks and hope they agree to the prices. So you can try to get rid of bias in that way. And this is a tool you don't have if it's just, you know, consent or don't consent.
I should just add in my acknowledgments that many of us participated in weekly privacy marketplace discussions, and that there are many views about what design, many views and designs for potential privacy preserving marketplaces, but a lot of discussion happened, and this is sort of a high level umbrella.
You brought up Blue Button. There's an aspect of Blue Button that hasn't been widely embraced, though it was put in by Markle, yeah. Which is OAuth, which is the ability for people to control in a fine-grained way what gets shared so that they do not have to download the data and move it to a third party that we're talking about in order to participate in the marketplace, but rather can provide direct point-to-point links with limited privileges. Do you have anything to say about that? In other words, is this kind of capability, to ask a question, essential to having a privacy-protecting marketplace?
Well,
is there any way of getting around that?
Well, the short answer is no. I don't need that at all. That's useless to me in most of the ways we think about privacy-preserving marketplaces, because all I really want from my insurance company is just give me my copy of the data, and you do what you're going to do, and I'm going to go do this other thing.
Somewhere.
Yeah, I'm going to put that data somewhere, but I'm putting it in a place that's making some guarantees to me about privacy or how the data is going to be used or whatever guarantees that marketplace makes that enables it to be privacy preserving. The insurance company, meanwhile, at the insurance company, there's no incentive for any of these participants to support a Blue Button campaign that requires consent. And that's why that option on Blue Button is never going to go anywhere.
I was part of the Blue Button panel, and
oh, that's great. I now have to disclose. So I'm part, you know, I'm on the HIT policy committee. So everything I
know
said
that.
Is my own opinion, okay. Not the administration.
But the reason that the OAuth feature was put in was because we realized that people would be tempted to share passwords because they didn't want to do the sneakernet thing with the data to right. Physically download it and move it. And even though people were wary of this separate capability, nobody could argue against it because everybody was even more concerned about the idea of people being encouraged to share their passwords.
Right.
So I'm surprised by your saying that this is a useless capability.
So when I say useless, what I mean by that is adoption. I'm speaking solely not from an academic or policy scholar position, but from the likelihood of adoption, the motivation to adopt that, but the motivation to get these players to participate in a privacy-preserving marketplace, a consent model, or anything that looks like that right now is really, really small. And what you'd be basically doing in the components that we were talking about earlier, you'd be working within a legacy environment. And trying to move those mountains is really, really hard. Huh? Legacy environment. And so you'd be much better. So all we're saying is, I don't think that's going to go anywhere. If it does, that's great. But I certainly don't need it to do anything to play the game of privacy-preserving marketplaces. I can pull the data out. I can put it in a place where people are going to make some guarantees to me, and I just don't have to use that. I mean, unless ONC requires
it. Can't work in the following sense. If the data is more valuable when it's live, when it's up to date, involving the individual in the pulling of the data out to that intermediate Microsoft Health Vault account, mm-hmm. Each time it's about to be probed, in other words, the sneakernet part of it, clearly cannot generate the highest value of the data.
I see.
The value of the data is an enabling computer to computer links.
I see.
Whether it's between a Microsoft Health Vault account that you control as an individual or by making a direct link between the managed care organization and the care provider under a tighter HIPAA, which
right.
might or might not exist.
Now, that aspect, the automation that I can automatically do that, is absolutely something that is essential to helping the privacy-preserving marketplace. The other aspects of that, of data sharing that they have to adhere to, is not.
This isn't clear to the HIT policy committee.
This
aspect of the Blue Button and OAuth.
The Blue Button campaign is not supported by the HIT policy committee.
All right, but so are you then saying that this is an essential capability for a privacy preserving marketplace now that we look at it in that way?
I'm saying that the ability to automate the person getting their data is extremely helpful for a privacy preserving marketplace. Whether that's part of a Blue Button campaign, whether that's done through some other means, is a different question. Right? But we should talk more about that. I don't want to. People are like, Blue Button. What about red buttons? What about those green buttons? So Blue Button campaign is just an effort by an outside foundation to make sure individuals actually are able to exercise their ability to get their data out of the healthcare organizations. And we're happy about that. No, not remove. Get a copy.
Okay. That would be too nice.
Get a copy. So, yes, sir.
Yeah, I was curious if you see any cultural differences, like between U.S. and Europeans or in other parts of the world, on their attitudes and interests in these privacy-preserving marketplaces. I mean, the discussions you've had have been driven mostly by American people or Europeans, or kind of is there some cultural differences?
Well, there are definitely cultural differences. You can see why in the United States environment it would spawn ideas like this. And it's probably not likely that these ideas would have spawned in Europe or Canada. But once they spawn, the benefits you can easily see. Suppose you do have multiple well-functioning, privacy-preserving marketplaces with a lot of buy-in and support, that's something that it's very easy for Europe or Canada to adopt. And they can do that quite easily. They could actually institute them much more easily than we can. So I think it has a tendency to bleed that way, and why it is it can't go, would not have been able to grow the other way. Well, thank you, guys. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.